This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Local Afghan officials say that Bagram Airfield, which is the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan, has come under a rocket attack. The U.S. government says it plans to shut down its two remaining consulates in Russia amid growing tensions between the two countries. Also in the headlines, India, the world's second most affected country after the U.S. in terms of coronavirus infections, passes the milestone of 10 million cases. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. Several rockets have reportedly hit a major U.S. airbase in Afghanistan's central province of Parwan. Local Afghan officials say that at least five projectiles targeted the Bagram airfield. Parwan authorities say the rockets were fired from the province's central area of Kalandar Hill. They say that several other rockets were foiled by police. No reports of any damage or casualties yet. American officials have also not commented about the attack. The base has been targeted by the Taliban militant group in the past. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump is planning to shut down two remaining consulates in Russia. A copy of notification obtained by U.S. media shows that the State Department had informed Congress of the decision last week. The closure of the missions in Vladivostok and Yekaterinburg would leave the U.S. with only its embassy in Moscow. The notice had cited caps placed by Russian authorities in 2017 on the number of American diplomats in the country as the reason. However, the move comes at a time of heightened tensions between the two nations amid the recent revelation of a massive cyber attack against numerous U.S. government departments and agencies. On Friday, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said that Russia was, quote, pretty clearly behind the cyber attacks. Moscow, however, has denied any involvement. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has criticized the U.S. for starting a new arms race, saying that Moscow's development of hypersonic weapons was a forced response to Washington. Marina Kurtanova reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual press conference. This year it was held in a new format, video conferencing, because of pandemic.
The end of the year Q&A session is a rare chance to get President Putin to answer important issues and draw attention to the country's problems. It has long become one of the biggest media events in the country, broadcasted live on main news channels and radio stations in Russia for the whole duration.
Speaking about the new START arms control treaty between Washington and Moscow, Putin accused the U.S. of starting a new arms race. Putin reiterated his call urging Washington to extend the new START arms control treaty for 1 year.
Now there's a threat that strategic arms reduction treaty is terminated. This would mean that there are no more restrictions on the arms race, none at all. We have called and continue to call our Western partners to extend this treaty for at least a year. During this year, we would have substantive talks, as diplomats say, on what to do next and how to live on.
Putin said he believed U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is open to dialogue on the issue, but added Russia needs some reaction from the U.S.
That it is the last point that connects the Russian Federation with the United States on strategic issues, because all other treaties and agreements signed by Soviet Union, Russian Federation, and the United States were dismissed, were destroyed by administration of Trump. Now we are entering a new period of development in American policy. That's why we hope that previous all agreements and treaties will be respected.
The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, also known as START, is the last remaining agreement that maintains a nuclear balance between the two countries. Putin also said that the unfounded poisoning scenario of opposition politician Alexei Navalny was in fact part of the U.S.-backed plot repeated by media to try to discredit the Russian leader. He stressed that Navalny was not important enough to be a target. Navalny, 44, was taken ill on a domestic flight on August 20. He was later transported to the German capital. German doctors, however, claimed Navalny had been poisoned with a substance from the group of cholinesterase inhibitors. Since then, Germany and other Western governments have been attacking Russia with accusations that it poisoned Navalny. Moscow has repeatedly and strongly rejected the allegation. Maria Putinova, Moscow.
The New York Police Department is found to have used excessive force to stop protests against police racism and brutality in the summer. New York City's Department of Investigation said the police use of excessive force and crowd control tactics fueled tensions during the protests. It said that officers made mass arrests, used batons and pepper sprays, and beat protesters indiscriminately. The report noted that the measures impinged on protesters' right to assemble and to express their views. The investigation was called in May after social media was flooded with videos of officers' violence, including, in one instance, ramming police vehicles into a crowd of protesters. The rallies were part of the protests over the police killing of unarmed African-American George Floyd, which soon morphed into the worst civil unrest in the U.S. in decades. Senior geopolitical analyst Alexander Azadgan: police unions in the U.S. have fueled police brutality by helping their members get away with their actions.
Black people are fed up just being downright murdered in front of cameras, and nothing really substantive being done to the police officers is a moral outrage. Of course, the majority of officers, we are told, are good people, kind people, law-abiding themselves, but the bad apples seem to really be getting away, you know, literally with murder. And part of that is because of the way the police unions are set up. They want to make sure these people are just not fired so they can get away with what they're getting away with. But from a greater picture, we are in the midst of a revolution. This is this is apparent to everyone who has the eyes to see and the wisdom to understand. The Black Lives Movement, has touched upon some very sensitive things that somehow were ignored more or less during the presidency of President Obama. I believe he was too reconciliatory. He wanted to play both sides of the fence, and now they're coming out in full force.
U.S. President Donald Trump has signed into law a two-day stopgap extension of existing federal funds to avoid a government shutdown amid the coronavirus pandemic. The president inked the legislation to keep the government running about an hour and a half before midnight deadline to pass spending legislation. The $900 billion bill would be part of a massive $1.4 trillion government spending package. The debate follows months of partisan finger-pointing and inaction with regards to the coronavirus crisis. Significant differences remain between Republicans and Democrats, including a dispute over a Republican-backed plan to rein in Federal Reserve lending programs. Democrats say that the measure would hamstring President-elect Joe Biden's ability to respond to the ongoing economic crisis after he takes office on January 20th. The coronavirus pandemic has enormously increased demand for food assistance in the U.S., even some of the country's affluent regions. An aerial video has showed hundreds of cars lining up at food banks in Los Angeles to pick up free groceries. People in many other states, like Alaska and Georgia, are also turning to food distribution centers. Activists say that food banks are under extra pressure ahead of the upcoming holidays, as requests have skyrocketed. They say that millions of Americans are barely making ends meet and need help to feed their families. Moreover, data by the U.S. Census Bureau indicates that more Americans are going hungry than at any point during the COVID-19 pandemic. Food insecurity has doubled since last year, reaching the highest level since 1998. India has passed the grim milestone of 10 million coronavirus cases with over 25,000 new infections in 24 hours. India remains the world's second most affected country after the U.S. in terms of infections. Elsewhere in Asia, South Korea reported more than 1,000 new infections for the fourth consecutive day, despite the country's tough mitigation efforts to contain the virus. It is now facing a severe shortage of hospital beds. In Australia, parts of its most populous city, Sydney, are going under new lockdowns. Australian officials say the new measures are aimed at containing new growing cluster of cases, adding that the whole city might come under a lockdown. In recent weeks, Australia had a rollback of restrictions ahead of the upcoming holiday season. A group of British MPs has warned that Britain has not yet provided all the complex IT systems and port infrastructure needed to ensure Brexit runs smoothly. The group said that they were concerned about the overall state of readiness. They warned that some decisions on infrastructure have been taken too late. London and Brussels should clinch an agreement by the end of this month. That is when a transition period following the UK's January withdrawal expires. The two sides want each other to compromise on key sticking points regarding their future trade. Both have raised the possibility of a no deal.
Before entering his latest and perhaps last round of negotiations with UK counterparts, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, addressed the European Parliament early on Friday morning.
Nous sommes à un moment de vérité.
It is the moment of truth.
Il nous reste,
we have very little time remaining, just a few hours to work through these negotiations in a useful fashion if we want this agreement to enter into force on the 1st of January.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before Britain might crash out of the Brexit transition period without a crucial EU trade deal.
Shameful UK government strategy.
Some EU lawmakers are in no doubt as to which side is to blame for the deadlock.
The UK government is taking endless time to realise that some illusions of Brexit simply cannot be delivered.
Many legislators claim the UK faces financial ruin if Boris Johnson's government fails to reach an agreement with the EU.
Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom.
It has been pointed out that long delays can already be witnessed at EU-UK border crossings.
Dear British friends, is this what you voted for? Passport stamps? And lorry queues? This moment is a victory for Europe.
But the European Union is in no position to gloat, it has been argued.
The real division isn't between the EU and the UK. It's between the haves and the have-nots. And we start dealing with that or there'll be a lot more Brexits to come.
Deal or no deal, business groups say the EU needs to pursue major structural reforms, especially in the context of Brexit.
There's a mismatch clearly, so we need better mobility. We need to be able to match the supply with the demand for workers across Europe, not just within member states.
Fishing rights remain the major sticking point in the negotiations. One EU lawmaker has reminded Boris Johnson that his closest ally will soon be history. The COVID-19 pandemic is still here, and so he should choose his next moves carefully. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Catalonia's parliament has approved an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders and pro-independence supporters. They are facing legal action in Spain's courts following the 2017 unilateral referendum on independence. Separatist lawmakers plan to push the bill through Spain's Congress next March.
The Parliament of Catalonia Friday approved an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders and the thousands of pro-independence supporters who were facing legal action for taking part in Catalonia's independence drive. The bill, which upholds amnesty and the right to self-determination as prerequisites to end the conflict, was backed by lawmakers from the three separatist parties who plan to push it through Spain's Congress next March.
Although lawmakers are aware that the bill has no chance of passing the floor of Congress in Madrid, they went on with it. Gerard Artigas, a parliamentary reporter, explains some of the reasons behind their move.
They know the law will not pass because the socialists in Madrid made clear they will not back it. They went on with it nonetheless, thinking that the Spanish Congress might be the right place to raise the debate on amnesty. Besides, they want to bring the bill to Congress in order to force all parties to take a position vis-a-vis amnesty, while at the same time they seek to take advantage of the Congress to sensitize the wider public about the jailed leaders.
Pro-Spanish unity parties in Catalonia's parliament vetoed the bill and dismissed the separatist claim of Spanish state repression in the northeastern region.
To approve the amnesty bill would mean admitting that Spain has been a dictatorship, and nobody buys that. All Western democracies recognize Spain as an equal, with its defects and virtues, but as an equal. Nobody in the international community is going to accept that in Spain there are political prisoners or repression, and therefore there is no room for amnesty.
Over the past 3 years, human rights NGO Amnesty International has repeatedly called on Spain to release two of the nine jailed Catalan leaders who have been sentenced for 9 years for sedition, a crime the NGO described as, quote, vague and against the principle of legality. Kusai Kedri, Barcelona.
An Afghan Taliban delegation led by its political chief visits Pakistan to discuss peace efforts. The visit comes as there is a 20-day break in the inter-Afghan dialogue, which has so far made little headway on the future of Afghanistan. Kamran Yusuf has more.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts.
The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire, as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war.
Taliban are convinced that the continuation of war is neither in their interest nor in the interest of Afghanistan. I get the feeling after my negotiations with the Taliban that they are serious to end this conflict, which is very encouraging.
Afghan Taliban and the US signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the US troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the US and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment.
Pakistan is in a position to use its lever, but it will not, I think. It will just facilitate. It will try, as Foreign Minister Qureshi has said in this event, that Pakistan will try to let the Afghan. There will be no imposition of any process on Afghan.
At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming U.S. president, as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course. On paper, there seems no change in the policy of U.S. President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan, but he may not hasten the troops' withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
And that is for World News.
Thank you.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Breaking with President Donald Trump's drive to overturn his election loss, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky on Tuesday, 15th of December, congratulated President-elect Joseph R. Biden on his victory and began a campaign to keep fellow Republicans from joining a doomed last-ditch effort to reverse the outcome of the election in Congress. Although Mitch McConnell waited until weeks after Joe Biden was declared the winner to recognize the outcome of the election, his actions were a clear bid by the majority leader in the Senate, who is the most powerful Republican in Congress, to put an end to his party's attempts to sow doubt about the election. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nicholas Fandos, Luke Broadwater, and Emily Cochrane. The piece is titled, Defying Trump, McConnell seeks to squelch bid to overturn the election. Breaking with President Trump's drive to overturn his election loss, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky on Tuesday, 15th of December, congratulated President-elect Joseph R. Biden on his election victory and began a campaign to keep fellow Republicans from joining a doomed last-ditch effort to reverse the outcome of the election in Congress. Although Mitch McConnell waited until weeks after Joe Biden was declared the winner to recognize the outcome of the election, his actions were a clear bid by the majority leader in the Senate, who is the most powerful Republican in Congress, to put an end to his party's attempts to sow doubt about the election. He was also trying to stave off a messy partisan spectacle on the floor of the House that could divide Republicans at the start of the new Congress, forcing them to choose either between showing loyalty to Donald Trump or protecting the sanctity of the electoral process. Many of us hoped that the presidential election would yield a different result, but our system of government has processes to determine who will be sworn in on 20th of January, Mitch McConnell said in a speech on the Senate floor. The Electoral College has spoken, so today I want to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden. Just a short time later, on a private call with the Senate Republicans, Mr. McConnell and his top deputies pleaded with their colleagues not to join members of the House in objecting to the election results on 6th of January, when Congress meets to ratify the Electoral College's decision, according to three people familiar with the conversation, who described it on the condition of anonymity. A small group of House members, led by Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama, plans to use a constitutional process to object to the inclusion of five key battleground states that day. There is almost no chance that they will succeed, but if they could persuade at least one senator to join them, they could force a vote on the matter, transforming a typically perfunctory session into a bitter last stand for Donald Trump. So far, no senator has committed to joining them. In seeking to prevent anyone from doing so, Mitch McConnell argued that a challenge would force senators to go on the record, either defying Donald Trump or rejecting the will of the voters, potentially harming those running for election in 2022. Mitch McConnell dispatched his top deputy, Senator John Thune of South Dakota, to lobby lawmakers one by one. The remarks were a decisive shift for Mitch McConnell. They came only after members of his leadership team in the Senate and even the chamber's chaplain began softening the ground by congratulating Joe Biden on Monday evening and Tuesday morning. Though he never repeated them, Mitch McConnell had allowed Donald Trump's false allegations of election fraud and fantastical claims that he has been the true winner to circulate unchecked for more than a month, defending the president's right to challenge the election outcome in courts of law. Allies insisted privately that he would ultimately honor the result of the election, but did not want to stoke a year-end conflict that could hurt the party's chances in two Georgia Senate runoffs and imperil must-pass legislation. That calculus changed dramatically late on Monday, 14th of December, after electors across the country cast their ballots for Joe Biden, cementing his 306-232 Electoral College victory. By Tuesday morning, Mitch McConnell and his leadership team were openly acknowledging the results and creating the political space for other Republicans to begin belatedly recognizing Joe Biden as the winner of the election. The Senate leader also spoke by phone with Joe Biden, apparently for the first time since his former Senate colleague won the presidency more than 5 weeks ago. "I called to thank him for the congratulations, told him although we disagree on a lot of things, there's things we can work together on," Joe Biden told reporters, adding that it was a good conversation. In normal times, such a call would have drawn little notice, but Donald Trump's push to deny his loss has created a charged political moment for Republicans, spotlighting rifts within the party and placing Mitch McConnell in a particularly dicey position. Opinion polls suggest a clear majority of Republicans believe Donald Trump's fabrication that the election was fraudulent, and they are likely to follow the president's words, not those of Mitch McConnell. Meanwhile, many of the president's allies in the House of Representatives continue to support his challenges to the results, with more than 60% of them signing on last week to a legal brief endorsing the failed effort by Texas to overturn results in key battleground states. The House of Representatives' top leaders were mostly silent on the question on Tuesday, and their aides did not respond to questions about Joe Biden's victory. Donald Trump himself showed no sign of backing down, repeating his false allegations on Twitter just after Mitch McConnell spoke. tremendous evidence pouring in on voter fraud. Donald Trump also shared a news article about Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama's efforts, raising the possibility that he could begin pressuring members of the party to join in, stoking an even bigger fight in the weeks ahead. Moving to head off potential backlash, Mitch McConnell told reporters pressing him to rebuke Donald Trump's rhetoric that he did not have any advice for Mr. Trump. Earlier in the day, before congratulating Joe Biden, Mitch McConnell had used his speech on the Senate floor to lavish praise on the president's record on foreign policy and domestic policy. The blowback was immediate from the party's outspoken right flank anyway, and foreshadowed the return to an old dynamic briefly abated during the Trump years, in which Mitch McConnell was a favorite punching bag for conservatives. Mark Levin, the talk radio host and strident supporter of Donald Trump, declared that Mitch McConnell had been AWOL from challenging the lawless acts of the Biden campaign and Democrats. "Trump helped you secure your seat, as he did so many Senate and House seats, and you couldn't even wait until 6th of January," Mr. Levin wrote on Twitter. "You've been the GOP leader in the Senate for far too long. It's time for some fresh thinking and for some new blood." Nor did Mitch McConnell earn much love from the few voices of Republican dissent that have raised alarms in recent days that Donald Trump's defiance of democratic norms and the acquiescence of much of his party would do lasting damage both to the GOP and to the country. One of them, Representative Paul Mitchell of Michigan, who is retiring, went as far as to quit the party on Monday in protest. Another, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, the Republican Party's 2012 presidential nominee, said on Tuesday that merely recognizing Joe Biden's victory was not enough for his party. How many Republicans will say that what the president is saying is simply wrong and dangerous? Mitt Romney said on CNN, "We need to have people who are strong. Trump supporters say that as well, or you are going to continue to have this country be divided, which is pretty dangerous."
The debate.
At the start of the 1960s, the UK embarked on a program of covert action in Latin America. While the work of U.S. intelligence in the region has been widely publicized, the UK role is much less known, but recently declassified files reveal attempts to influence elections and disrupt trade unions in a number of Latin American countries. At the behest of the British Foreign Office and MI6, the decision was taken in London in 1961 to increase covert activities where the role of Britain was kept hidden, with a particular focus on black propaganda, which involves false material and being deliberately misleading about who is producing it. With the British historically known for meddling in countries like Iran, India, Palestine, and so on, what was the actual extent of their interference in Latin America? Well, let's start off this segment with our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London. Amina, why hasn't this story been covered by mainstream media?
but from places from Ecuador, Cuba, Chile, when you have statements where there's a little gold star attached to Venezuela, where it says, oh, a very rich target, very good because of its resources, it shows where Britain's concerns were. It was about influence, that extending that sphere of influence, running alongside America and essentially picking up any of the diplomatic scraps that were left there and building its own, but about establishing its own kind of dual power base where it could, if things didn't go well, as if it didn't in some of the cases, you could easily shift the blame to Washington and say, well, look at those guys, you know? Britain's been far more sneaky in its endeavors, and I think this recently released cache of documents shows that it's not really a surprise to those who are watching this historically, and goodness knows what the next 50 years or so will bring, because if, touch wood, I'm alive to look at those new documents that will surely be revealed about the extent of British influence in the region now, I think so many of us will realize we've just skimmed the very surface, Bardia.
All right, thanks a lot. That was our London correspondent, Amina Taylor. Let's bring in Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who's with us from San Francisco. Mr. Becker, welcome to the program. Why do you think the UK carried out these operations in Latin America?
Well, I think that we must remember that for a century and a half, Britain was the dominant empire in the world. And its empire included, although it was really a prelude to a widespread neocolonialism, the relationship to much of Latin America was a neocolonial relationship in that it didn't involve widespread conquering of territory. There was British Honduras, now Belize, and British Guyana, now Guyana, and the Falkland Islands, they called them the Malvinas, the Argentinians do. But it was more an economically dominant relationship of extreme exploitation of many countries, Venezuela, the gold mines of Venezuela, and gold and Venezuela have come back into the news this year. The relationship with Argentina, which was really in many ways kind of the breadbasket of England for beef and for wheat and so forth. So there's that long-term relationship. 100 years ago or 120 years ago, half of all of the foreign investment in Latin America was British foreign investment. It's not nothing like that now. It's really more like 1% or 2% of the foreign investment. But Britain is looking to restore a much stronger position in Latin America, and particularly as Brexit approaches. And that would be, particularly in regard to food, food imports into England. I think the bottom line is this, is that Britain was once the dominant foreign power in Latin America. It no longer is anything close to that. The British, as your correspondent said, have always been willing to take the scraps off the table as the junior partner of U.S. imperialism, whether it was in Iran or it's in Iraq, or in Afghanistan or in Libya. You know, the British government has, since World War II, with lots of contradictions, which I don't want to underestimate in any way, but has been the junior partner of the U.S., faithful servant. And, you know, back in the early days of the Iraq War, there were the depictions of the British Prime Minister as the lapdog, and that was certainly an appropriate depiction.
Latin America expert Isaac Biggio joins us now, also from the British capital, London. Mr. Biggio, welcome to Press TV's debate. This would appear puzzling to many. The UK at that point was overstretched. Latin America fell outside its area of strategic interest, and UK covert action was in fact dwarfed by that of the US. Why the effort then?
Well, you have to understand that the UK was the main power that created Latin America, because the UK supported the independence movements against Spain, 5,000 UK troops supported Simón Bolívar. Then the UK was the dominant power, the dominant foreign power in Latin America for more than one century. It was involved in the Chilean, in the war between Chile, Peru, and Bolivia, in the Paraguayan, in the two Paraguayan wars. Depending on the unity of Brazil, when it has some secession movements in the 1820s. So it had a dominant power, and the pound was the main currency in Latin America until the First World War. So Britain was perhaps the main power until the Second World War. So it lost its hegemony toward the United States, but it always tried to keep some influence. And we saw in this document, the 1960s, the UK tried to overthrow the Cuban government to stop Allende taking power in 64, against an Ecuadorian nationalist government. The UK was working with the United States, albeit the UK never restored its dominant position in Latin America.
Mr. Becker, based on the files declassified in 2019 and 2020, the UK reportedly worked on trade unions through infiltrating and capturing them or disrupting meetings. We can see that the level of interference was widespread. Why was this information not disclosed sooner? Why now?
Well, of course, the governments of the United States and Britain, France, Germany, they all want to keep their what they're really doing hidden. They want to be able to pretend, oh, we're the forces for democracy in the world against the forces of evil and all that. And so to expose the fact that they're really intervening in this heinous ways in the people's movements in Latin America and around the world, meaning trade unions in particular, which have a particular importance and particular power, and in governments and political parties. This is, very widespread. But as I say, exposing that to the public view really puts a dent in the idea that these are really democratic countries and that they're interested in upholding democracy. You know, they all were fine with the brutal, murderous, indescribable dictatorships in Latin America that came into being, started in Brazil in 64, and then, in Chile and Argentina and Uruguay and all over the continent, just about. These really brutal regimes, they were fine with, they were supported by Washington and by London and by their other allies. So this, I think that explains the fact that the mass media, the corporate mass media in both countries, really, when push comes to shove, acts as a voice of the government, acts as another branch of the government, in fact. And it has to be investigative reporting that's done to dig through, all the material and find the truth of what's been going on and expose it to the world.
Isaac Biggio, in 1961, London decided to increase the covert activities where the role of Britain was kept hidden, with a particular focus on black propaganda, where people are deliberately misled about who is producing it. Talking about corporate mass media, which Mr. Becker just mentioned right now, the BBC has allegedly been complicit in such actions. That wasn't just in Latin America, was it? We have Iran, we have India, and other countries coming to mind immediately.
Yeah, well, the BBC has never been neutral, no? But why this year is so important? Because this is the year in which Cuba decided to become a socialist country. It became close to the Soviet Union. It was the first time that the Soviet Union have an important ally in the Americas. The UK and the United States were very much afraid that the Cuban revolution could be expanded. So they tried to stop government like the one, left-wing governments like the one in Brazil. They tried to combat nationalist movement, to fight against nationalist movements in the continent. And, well, as you know, the law London has always a policy to defend their own interests in the war, no? In the Middle East, in Africa. London used to be the most important overseas empire in world history. After the Second World War, the UK lost it, gradually it lost its empire, but it tried to keep some influence with the Commonwealth and working together with the United States with a special relation. In the case of Latin America, a very important issue that united London and Washington was to stop Moscow in Cuba and to stop the spread of the Cuban Revolution.
Sure, Mr. Becker. The operations included creating a new magazine in Colombia, distributing pamphlets in Chile and Bolivia. Local radio producers were bribed to get airtime and produce tapes to be played. Doesn't that bear the hallmarks of the British colonial meddling in the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and elsewhere?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it wasn't just Britain, but even on a much greater scale, the United States did the same. There's a very interesting book that came out several years ago called The Cultural Cold War, about there was a vast plan of that included the tours of dance companies and theater companies and the production of books and pamphlets and movies and videos and everything you can imagine by the U.S. and the British on a smaller scale but still significant scale to try to delude public opinion in different parts of the world in their favor. And, you know, I have to say this, that the, you know, back in 1895, when the U.S. and Britain almost went to war over Venezuela, and they settled it, but the British got to keep their gold mines, which was their big priority in Venezuela. Now today, in July of this year, the British High Court ruled that the Britain did not have to turn over a billion dollars in gold bullion that's in its the Bank of England account to Venezuela, saying that Juan Guaido, this imposter, this really, you know, a figure who will be remembered, I think, as a comedy in history, that his government was the legitimate one, even though he hadn't run for president, that he was the legitimate president. And this, again, following in the footsteps of the United States, following and promoting the U.S. policy as well. But there we have 125-year link between of gold in the relationship of England, of Britain, to Latin America. It's the same thing continues in just different forms.
Right. And, Mr. Bijo, as you mentioned earlier, this was in the 60s, but when we look at the dispute, for example, with the Malvinas Islands and the war that took place in 1982, the colonial attitude towards Latin America wasn't confined to just one certain period, was it?
Well, United Kingdom always tried to have ambitions in the Americas. There are several countries in the Americas that accept Elizabeth II as their queen, Belize, Jamaica. There are many Commonwealth countries, Guyana, for example. And Britain tried to create colonies in what is now Argentina, you know, they tried to Buenos Aires, and finally, I think in 1839, in the 1830s, they took what the Argentina called Malvinas and what they call them the Falklands. And in this war, it was very important for Thatcher, as you can see in this film from the royal family, you know, The Crown, that Thatcher used the Malvinas Falkland War to consolidate her power. Without that war, she would have been removed from power because it was quite unpopular. And it was the first and only time that we had a war inside the Antarctic area, because part of the war were in Georgia and the Sandwich Islands. So the UK has always tried to keep their influence in the Americas, albeit now is not so important. And allow me to talk about something about Guaido, because the other person talk about that. We had just in Venezuela, on the 12th of December, Guaido organized a referendum. When the Catalans did a referendum, they were not allowed to do that. There were more than 1,000 people arrested, and the European Union supported Spain. When Guaido organized a referendum, that there was no repression on that referendum. Until now, nobody knows what are the results. Everybody could vote. People can vote 3, 4, 5 times. People can vote even forging their documents. There is no international control, and despite all of that, Guaido is being recognized as the president of Venezuela, and the USA said that this is a legitimate election. The one that Trump lost in the United States is not a legitimate election, but this one it is. So this is the kind of democracy which the main powers are promoting. It doesn't matter what is the opinion of the population, it's their interest, and they are supporting Guaido. It's incredible. They are still supporting Guaido and recognizing him as a president, the only president in America without control of their own country.
That's a very interesting point you brought up there, Richard Becker. I'd like you to comment on that as well. What similarities can be drawn to what is happening today, for example, with Venezuela or Syria, for that matter?
Well, I think that it's very clear that what's happening to Venezuela, there's a true disaster going on in Venezuela, that the cutting off of virtually all trade is a terrible, and it's reminiscent of what was done to Iran back in the early 1950s, when Mossadegh was the elected head of government. And we see this also in Syria. And what do we see in all these countries? We see hungry people, people who don't have medical supplies, because these sanctions, as they're called, these what are really amount to international blockades, are imposed, and Britain participates fully in it. The U.S. leads the way, but it's a disaster for the people of all those countries. And these sanctions should really be declared as crimes against humanity. They're nothing less.
All right, gentlemen, let's leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Mr. Isaac Biggio, joining us from the British capital, London. He's a Latin America expert. Also thanks to Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, speaking to us from San Francisco. Also, special thanks to you all for staying with us on this debate. It's goodbye. Until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be addressing a question that often comes in the minds of people who are aware of the nature of the beliefs of the pagan Arabs who were present at the time of the genesis of Islam. We can pose this question in the following way. When we look at the verses of the Holy Quran, we see that in many verses of the Holy Quran, God says that these Arabs who were present at the time of the descent of the Quran and the beginning of the Islamic religion, they admitted God's attribute of being the creator of the universe, meaning they admitted that God is the creator of the universe. So the question arises, what exactly was the point of difference between them and the Islamic beliefs and the message of Islam that was bringing? The answer to this question is this, that while it's true that these people admitted that God is the creator of the universe, they also, on the contrary, conversely, they said that God, after creating the universe and the beings in the universe, one of which was man, he handed over the affairs of the universe, the caretaking of the universe, its nourishment, its training, its upbringing, its regulation, to a series of demigods. And these demigods were had the responsibility of overseeing the affairs of the universe. This was the reason why these beings worshipped these idols. Of course, this was one of the reasons why idolatry and polytheism began to spread in the Arabian Peninsula. There's other reasons as well. For example, some historians say that these Arabs argued by saying that it's impossible for a human being to conceive of the ultimate deity who created the universe. And because of this, insufficiency and deficiency in knowledge and an understanding of this being, it would be impossible to worship that being, as worship is subordinate to understanding and the comprehension of the being that you're worshiping. So because of that, they said that because we don't have access to that being, that ultimate being, we worship these demigods as they are mediums between us and that ultimate God. This was another reason why polytheism became prevalent in that place. In any case, the Quran, it rejects this idea that these demigods or these subordinate beings, it was the responsibility of them to regulate the affairs of the universe. Rather, God Almighty says that this is an exclusive property of God. It calls this Tawheed